Okay, we're ready for the final session. This one, make sure you stay for this one. This one's going to be really good. This session's called Technology Trends: What's Certain, What's Less Certain, and What's the Alpha Trend? So we're very fortunate today to have Trevor Grusin here with us. And I'm not even going to tell you about his presentation, I'm just going to let him do it, but I'll just introduce him briefly and then hand over to Trevor. He's the Senior Managing Director responsible for Asia Pacific, Africa, Middle East and Turkey with Accenture Strategy. His role focuses on advising companies and governments on strategy, that is business, IT and digital, innovation applied to business and operating models and transformation. His specific focus is on how technology can disrupt companies and industries. So over to you, Trevor.
Thanks, Mel. Thank you. As Melissa said, my name is Trevor Grusin. I look after Accenture Strategy for Asia Pacific. If fate hadn't intervened, I would be in the audience listening to somebody else talking today, because 30 plus years ago I applied and was accepted to study actuarial science when I first left school. And I have a huge respect for this group's brain power, because I know how hard it is to get in. I'm not saying I would have passed, but but what happened is when I went to a university which was 1,500 kilometres from home, because the university in my hometown didn't offer actuarial science. And I got there in the morning. There was no computer registration, so you had to stand in a line in the Great Hall, and there was like law, medicine, commerce, computing, actuarial science. So being eager, I joined the actuarial science. I was the first person there in the morning. And everyone was busy registering on the day, and like the registrar for actuarial science just was late. And at a break, while I was getting frustrated, the person in the line next to me registering people for computing said, look, the course is exactly the same in the first year. Why don't you register for computing? And I sat there thinking, my parents had like saved every last dime to send me to university, and like here I am registering for a course that wasn't what I went down for, but I decided to register for computer science, and the rest is history. I never went back to actuarial. So, but I must say I've known Nicolette and Melinda for a while, and I've never met a large group of actuaries before, but I will say I've been here for the day, and I felt very much at home. So maybe if I had registered, I would be very happy with my career choice. I mean, everyone walks around very friendly, smiling, like I'm one of you. It's like if I'd been at an investment banking conference today with bond traders, I can absolutely assure you I wouldn't have had the warm welcome I felt during the course of today. Anyhow, so I'm going to do a presentation on technology trends. When Nikki first asked me to do it, I said there are three versions of this presentation. There's one with slides, there's one with videos and sort of multimedia, and then there's one with no slides but a virtual extended reality co-presenting with me. But we've never done it in Australia yet. And Nikki said, do the third. So I'm doing it today. It's the first time we've done it. And I'm going to be co-presenting in an extended reality to give you a flavor of the new technology. I'm going to cover five trends today. The first one's called digital citizen AI, or what Google calls responsible AI. Second one, extended reality, and you'll actually see that. Third one, data veracity. You don't need to go far from any newspaper to read about data, trust, privacy. Fourth one is frictionless commerce and how companies work together. You heard that last answer there, which I thought was very good. And the fifth one is the Internet of Thinking. Not the Internet of Things, but the Internet of Thinking. And it all comes together in the Intelligent Enterprise Unleashed, which is our company's 2018 version of the technology trends. We've been doing these for 18 years, by the way. So to start the ball rolling, let me introduce my assistant. Oh, we've lost sound. Nah. The problem is we lost sound, so can we go back to do that again?
Are more closely connected than ever before. Trust, transparency, partnerships, powered by technology, are the essential ingredients which unleash the intelligent enterprise.
Okay, so unfortunately you missed the beginning part of that, but don't worry, there are many more co-presenting moments and you'll get a flavour. This presentation, by the way, is relatively cheap to put together, under $10,000. You need an iPhone, you need a Apple TV, and you'll see how accessible and easily deployed this technology is. I should start by saying that everything I'm going to say to you today is probably going to be out of date in 6 to 12 months' time. It's going to seem dated. A few years ago in our tech vision, we said every business is a digital business and most corporates will move their technology onto the cloud. And we got a lot of pushback on social media and elsewhere saying, like, how can you say that? Because the public cloud is a lot less secure than the private cloud. Turns out we now know that the public cloud is much more secure than the private cloud and hosted systems inside of the four walls of a corporation. And where we were less than 5% just a few years ago in the public cloud, we're now 23, 24%, heading towards 30 and 40, and we'll soon be over 50. It's an unstoppable train. So things move very, very quickly, and I think you had multiple points of view in the last presentation. I'm definitely on the side of the people who, you know, kind of see a lot of change coming with technology. I think we don't always get things right. No one could have foreseen while we continue to push for hyper-personalization and capturing huge amounts of data, no one could have foreseen the trust and privacy issues as they've exploded and need to be dealt with. And they are being dealt with, and I'll talk a little bit about what Facebook are doing and others. I'd say most of you on your way here today would have used these five trends. You know, you would have, if you'd come here in a car and driven here and you'd used your in-car navigation, you would have got a very different estimate of the time to get to this hotel and the route to take. I mean, I don't know if anyone has used Waze before, but this morning on my way here, I put the destination in my car, which is a BMW, on Apple Maps, Google Maps, and Waze. And, you know, if you haven't used Waze, Waze has got a lot more AI than a traditional car navigation and will actually tell you not just how long it's going to take, which, by the way, is always longer than the in-car navigation, but where the roadblocks are or high traffic, that it will tell you during the day that if you're going between point A and point B, how long it's going to take you now versus in half an hour versus in 2 hours, so you can plan your time. And the intelligence that's going into that, which is AI basically knowing from ongoing updates how long it takes to get from various places to other places, but also there are thousands of these Wazians who are continually entering data onto the system, so it's human and machine, and that's going to be a factor of my a big point in the presentation. We're not losing all our jobs to AI, and I'll talk about that later. There's a whole range of new jobs. If you'd used Gmail, and you got here early this morning, Gmail would have recommended additional recipients when you're typing a response. And it's knowing that by your past behavior. If you'd come here on Uber and you'd rated the driver and the driver had rated you, you're creating more trust in that system, but also putting more of your data out in the public domain. If you'd walked in here, undoubtedly you would have been photographed many times. And I've got a video, which I won't show you today, would have been version B of this presentation, of a city in China where there are thousands of CCTV cameras and a BBC journalist goes to the police and says, flag me as a wanted criminal and I'm going to see how long I can evade being captured in the city. It takes 5 minutes before he's caught. It's a fascinating video. I'd be happy to share that with Mel afterwards to share to you. And if you got here earlier and you bought something on Amazon, by the way, has the highest brand value in the world today, just overtaken Apple and Google and Disney and Coke. It is the most trusted company in the world. It wins the highest customer service award globally now on all continents. And it does that because it's provided recommendations which you've come to trust. If you've ever bought anything, I buy my Christmas presents now on Amazon. You can return at the end of your holiday, or at the end of the holiday, any presents you want. And there's 8 reasons. And the 8th one is, I've changed my mind. None of those awkward conversations trying to explain to people why you made a decision. I've changed my mind. And it's to the point now where in the US, and it's going to come to Australia, you can have Amazon stuff delivered to your car, which you can unlock remotely or give them access. You can have it delivered to your house where they've got access. And in China, with Alibaba, you can actually tell them where to put it in the kitchen when they deliver the goods. So there's, you know, the benefits, this is where I would disagree very respectfully with a professor, I'm sure is a lot smarter than me, but I think there's massive consumer benefits in some of these new technologies that are going out there. So my objective today is to make you think, to get some insights that you can take back to your work, and without any further ado, let's get into the first trend. We call this the mega trend or the alpha trend, AI, which we see as impactful going forward as the internet was in the 90s and mobile was in the 2000s. So let's have a look at AI.
Citizen AI, raising AI to benefit business and society. As artificial intelligence grows in its capabilities and its impact on people's lives, businesses must move to raise their AIs to act as responsible, productive members of society.
Okay, so citizen AI, it's a really interesting point. You need to raise AI as a citizen, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. But just to go back to basics, what is AI? AI comprises two components. It comprises a learning engine, and it comprises an inference engine. The learning engine tries to replicate how humans learn by observing things and forming a model with help. And then the inference engine allows you, using that model, to make recommendations and predictions. Let's look at how children learn. When we bring a child into the world and we teach them about animals, we show them thousands of photos of animals. We take them to the zoo. We show them movies. We show them TV shows. We show them pictures and books. And as the children get exposed to these different animals, they form a mental model of what a dog looks like, what a cat looks like. And when you expose them to a new breed, going for a walk, they can point to it and say dog or doggy and do a barking noise or whatever it is we've associated with that. And as we provide feedback to the child, we improve the model in their brain. Well, and that's how an AI system works, is you feed it tons of data and it forms a model of what it's seeing and picks up variables that sometimes we never see. I'm not going to have time today, but there's some amazing stories of how we've used this with big telcos in Europe where we've come up with new insights no one ever thought of before that despite being immersed in that business. And when you think about the world of actuaries and work around underwriting or life expectancy or health and creating those models, you know, that's, you can see that as an area that's ripe for sort of further investigation going forward. And just as a child learns something, and sometimes you can't get it to forget, like we all know when a child picks up a swear word, and then no matter what you do, they can never unlearn that word. In fact, the more you tell them to stop, the more they say it. If you've seen the movie Meet the Parents, the second one in the series, Meet the Fockers, where Ben Stiller uses a swear word and to his nephew and just cannot get the kid to stop using that swear word, you'll know what I mean. And the same way, when you, these AI systems, when they learn something, you can't just reprogram them because it's not like they've got lines of code that you can go in and change. They built a neural network of that, and it's very hard to get it to unlearn it. And that's why we talk about citizen AI or responsible AI, because you've got to train them in a responsible way like a child. Microsoft recently launched a product, an offering called Tay Tweets, where this AI engine learned and watched people tweeting and then tried to replicate and act as a tweeter, like a human. The problem is, it worked really well, but it also picked up hate speech. And it was making incredibly awful comments to people, you know, who'd signed on to try out this engine. And in the end, Microsoft shut it down, because they couldn't just go in and reprogram those couple of lines. And so, you know, this AI is we talk about this responsible AI. Now, we don't have a huge amount of time, but let me give you a couple of examples. With autonomous vehicles that came up earlier today, there's five levels of autonomy, if you've looked at this. All the cars on the road today are level 2 or 1. There's nothing that's level 3 and beyond. Even the Teslas are level 2. Level 3 is where the system can take over and doesn't require a driver. Audi is next year is going to release level 3 for the A8. It's already in production. And by the way, level 3, the auto manufacturer signs on to taking responsibility for the accident. So Audi have already said, in traffic jam situations, low speed, for the A8 next year, they will take responsibility for all accidents on the A8. So that kind of, you know, the AI that's coming there is coming fast. I mean, even my daughter's 18. She's got a $20,000 Golf, and it now does reverse parking on its own. And, you know, there's so much coming at such a breakneck speed. When you use Google Translate, 500 million people use it a month. That's using AI. If you go into Netflix, I'm sure most of the audience has Netflix. There are 5 people in my family. When I go on under my profile, it recommends very different movies to my 13-year-old son or my 18-year-old daughter or my wife. So the AI that's coming through in all these applications is pervasive in our life. One other story before I just wrap up the AI. There's a great story that's out at the moment of a Chinese national who learnt English in China. Star pupil at school, star pupil at university, spent 2,500 hours studying English. The European recommendation is 1,100 to 1,200 hours to be master at a new language. And he went to the States, to Princeton University, one of the most prestigious universities, went into McDonald's on his first night in the States and could not have a conversation with the guy. He couldn't understand the person who's ordering from. The person that was taking his order couldn't understand him. And he said, there's something wrong with our learning system. So he's built an AI system called, I'm sure if there are any Chinese nationals in the room, they're going to self-pronounce it wrong. It's called Liu Lishuo. It's got 100 million people on it, and it basically teaches you English, but you practice, and the system basically, if you're on a bus for 5 minutes, it plays you some text. You can say it back, and the system provides coaching at that point in time, and it's dramatically cut the amount of time to learn English, and it's much cheaper, and it's kind of taking off. And so this whole area of AI is huge. It's why we call it the mega trend. If you go and look at Google last week, they launched something at their conference called the Duplex, where they showed a video, you can go and see it on YouTube, of an AI engine making an appointment for a woman called Lisa at a hairdresser. And, you know, she phones up the assistant, and the assistant says, you know, she says, can I have an appointment at 2? And the assistant says, I haven't got anything at 2, but how about 3 o'clock? And she says, like she thinks, you know, this is an AI engine. It goes, probably not. Can we try the morning? And she's got all this very human intonation. And Alan Finkel, the chief scientist of Australia, basically came on ABC Radio on Friday and said, he was like amazed but horrified. And he's asked the Australian government to look at introducing legislation to tell you when you're talking to a robot because it's so real. Now, the one thing, at the earlier presentation today by my friends from Deloitte, there was a very good question at the end about jobs. Are all the jobs going? And what about those people that learn to be actuaries as consultants and analysts? And our company's view is absolutely the jobs are not going. There's a whole lot of new jobs coming. And by the way, everyone focuses on the jobs that are going, but it's how humans and machines work together. We call that the missing middle. And there are 3 really important jobs there. There's a book that's just been released by our chief technology officer. There's the trainers, sustainers, explainers. And we know from the Royal Commission, I mean, when decisions are made, governments expect us to explain how and why we got to a decision. We call those explainers. Sustainers are people that help build the engine and do the feedback loop. So we think that the jobs aren't all going. There's a new set of jobs coming, and the jobs are going to be even better. And somebody who explained from Deloitte the answer this morning said when she first started as an actuary, she had to do tables manually or life expectancy or I forget what the answer was. And, you know, that's now been automated, but she's went on to a higher-level job. So that's AI. Let's go on to our second trend, which is extended reality.
Extended reality. The end of distance. Virtual and augmented reality technologies are removing the distance to people, information, and experiences, transforming the ways people live and work.
So what I was trying to do there is peer through the porthole and show you how I can co-present with the animation experience that was going on there. Probably all of you in the room have experienced Pokemon Go. I mean, that's where children go around on a map of Sydney or anywhere in the world and collect Pokemon and get points, and that's a great example of augmented reality. If anyone's seen the movie Ready Player One, Steven Spielberg's latest hit. It's a great introduction into augmented reality, virtual reality. On the iPhone, one of the things when they launched the iPhone X, Tim Cook showed a virtual tape measure. I don't know if anyone saw the thing. So outside on the banner board, I used this tape measure. Actually, I used this morning. This is 1.9 meters. I used a virtual tape measure on my iPhone this morning. So, you know, it's becoming quite pervasive. The question is, can companies use this? Can you make money out of this? We know Nintendo, the owner of Pokemon, is making a ton of money. Their share price has gone crazy. And we know Steven Spielberg made a lot of money and the Ready Player One crew. But, you know, are real companies using it? So let me give you a couple of examples. Once a year in the States, they have something called Black Friday. And if you've ever seen it on TV, it's like serious mayhem. They have incredible bargains. People line up at midnight or whenever the stores open, and they literally trample each other, fight each other for those bargains. Happens once a year. Most store managers or employees, because of high turnover, have never experienced Black Friday before, and so they don't know how to cope with the mayhem. So what they've done is they've created a virtual reality training environment to help people get ready for Black Friday. And that's an example of a company using it. DHL are using smart glasses when people are going through the warehouse to find certain packages and they can't find them. They can get assistance remotely. It's why we talk about extended reality as the end of distance. The next version of Google Maps, by the way, when you get to your location and you're stuck, you can switch to Street View, got announced last week, and then it will point arrows at the actual street so you can see. You don't have to follow a map. You'll be able to follow a real live replica of the environment around you. So that's extended reality, and we think that that's a big thing, and it's lots of organizations are using it, but in the spirit of time, I won't do any more. Let's talk about our next trend, data veracity. I think it's really important for this audience.
Data veracity, the importance of trust. By transforming themselves to run on data, businesses have created a new kind of vulnerability. Inaccurate, manipulated, and biased data that leads to corrupted business insights and skewed decisions with a major impact on society.
Okay, so I think like data, as I said at the beginning, you cannot pick up a newspaper today and not read about the issues of data, trust. You know, there's so much going on here. There's the volume of data being collected. There's how long it's kept for. There's the whole issue of right to be forgotten, which is legislation that's been implemented in Europe, not yet in Australia. In fact, Australia said they're not going to do it for now, where you can go onto Google and say, that is an unfair comment about me. I demand that be forgotten. It's how the data is used to influence buying. Think about Amazon. It's how it understands intent. Think of Google knowing more about your intent than possibly anyone else besides you. It talks about accuracy and the whole issue of fake news at the moment. There's an onslaught on the truth. There's a recent survey I saw last week that 65% of people don't have a trusted source of the truth because this whole thing with fake news, they don't know who to trust anymore. And this whole issue of privacy. So we all read about it with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. You know, it's not a new issue. In 1983, this issue of data accuracy is a great story. When in the height of the Cold War, there's a Soviet watch officer called Stanislav Petrov, whose job was to monitor for incoming missiles. And he saw a missile attack heading towards Russia. This is a true story. And his instant reaction was, I should report this to my superiors. And if he had, there would have almost certainly been a counterattack launched and the world would not be the way it is today. Instead, he said, you know, all my training has taught me that when a nuclear attack occurs, there's going to be a lot of signals. There's going to be planes being mobilized. I'll see a lot of signals. And there was only one signal going off, which was these nuclear missiles heading. Turned out it was a false positive. It was sunlight off clouds at a certain angle on a certain day. And he was able to apply judgment and context, which is, you know, really important in the spirit of data. And so as we read about this issue of trust and privacy, you know, we think leveraging technology is going to be hugely important for competitive advantage. And one of the other areas of competitive advantage is building trust, the way Amazon does. That's going to be an area of advantage. And it's interesting with Facebook now, in responding to the thing that's happened, they've signaled the intent to hire another 10,000 humans to complement the AI engines they've launched. They've just launched three AI engines, one to look for nudity on Facebook. By the way, they're getting a 96% hit rate on removing nudity using the AI engine. They've launched one on hate speech. They're getting a very low hit rate, like less than 35%. Because hate speech depends on context, like that example. What hate speech can be by a comedian about his or her own race or religion is not interpreted by anyone who listens to it as hate speech, yet the AI engine doesn't have the sophistication to cope. And then this whole thing about fake profiles. I mean, Facebook's removed, I think, over half a billion fake profiles. Yeah, half a billion over the past several months. And then the other thing with privacy, you know, just in the European Union, this Friday, like in 4 days' time, GDPR. I don't know who's heard of GDPR. Okay, most of the room. General Data Protection Regulation goes live. If anyone has got a smartphone, you would have received emails over the past 2 or 3 days. I got one from Twitter yesterday. I got one from my bank yesterday. I got one from Macquarie this morning. I got one from Heathrow Airport, of all places, literally overnight, saying, we have data about you. Will you consent to us keeping it, or should we delete it? Here's our policy on how we're going to delete it. So I'd say the European Union is leading on data privacy. But, you know, that's an area of trying to navigate between hyper-personalization and all the benefits that come with that, yet the right to privacy, the right to be forgotten, is an area that we still need to navigate our way through. And that's part of this whole data veracity space. So let's look at the fourth trend, frictionless commerce.
Frictionless business, built to partner at scale. Businesses depend on technology-based partnerships for growth, but their own legacy systems aren't designed to support partnerships at scale. To fully power the increasingly embedded enterprise, companies must first re-architect themselves.
Okay, look, I think, you know, in the spirit of it's been a long day, I won't bore you with lots of examples here. I'd say this is a space that we've seen for decades, how companies partner with each other. The thing that's changed is the speed and the breadth and depth of those relationships. And if you've all, there's two words I'd like to leave you with. One is called APIs, if you haven't heard the word. APIs are a way that companies expose their services to others, both inside their own company, across the silos, but to other companies in the marketplace, to let you interact and work together more closely. I'll give you an example in a moment. And the big trend that's coming today is something called microservices, where you take big chunks of capability. You heard earlier on the money lending initiative that was discussed. You know, that you could imagine any financial institution that wants to tap into that may want to create an exchange or an interface. We'll do that through APIs and microservices. Think of a Lego that you've constructed at home with your family or your children. The microservices are some of those building blocks, not necessarily one, but building blocks where you can go and access bits of capability and expose that to the outside world. And that development, and everyone's doing it, by the way, all the big companies, all the big IT departments are looking at open architectures, open banking, APIs, microservices. That's the technology that's being done to create this massively interconnected world. So to give you an example, you know, one of the pharmacies that we've been tracking, when you go in and apply for, put in a script, if it's got a reward program, if it requires special government approval, if it requires checking that you're not on some list, that you're not meant to get that script. I was listening on ABC Radio yesterday about the problem with fentanyl and opioids in Australia. I mean, it's crazy, the addiction to fentanyl. But there are lists that people don't go to, and those could be accessed through microservices. So there are pharmacies that are doing that, and all big companies. When you go to Google and you do a search, you get your answer back in less than a second. On average, Google has called 70 microservices to help answer your question. So that's what the world of frictionless business is. It's about creating these massively granular bits of capability across massive ecosystems and hooking them up so you can just deliver much greater value to your customers. And let's look at the final trend, the Internet of Thinking.
Internet of Thinking. Creating intelligent distributed systems. Businesses are making big bets on intelligent environments via robotics, AI, and immersive experiences. But to bring these intelligent environments to life, they must extend their infrastructures into the dynamic, real-world environments they want to reach.
So if you hold that image, the Internet of Thinking is about lots of connected devices to a cloud. So they're all connected to each other through the cloud. Now, in the first version of the Internet, it was really about business to consumer, and then we've seen this explosion of something called machine to machine, or the Internet of Things, and you've kind of seen that where you put technology out into the marketplace that can send signals back to the cloud that you can react to. The Internet of Thinking takes that to the next level, where we put intelligence into those devices that are out at the edge. We call it the edge of the cloud. So I'll give you a great example. A pacemaker in your heart is really a device that's put in there that does a certain function, but it doesn't have the intelligence to make certain decisions if certain things occurs. It just does a job. There's a product called NeuroPace, which has been developed and implanted in people's skulls that have epilepsy, or that suffer from epilepsy. And what it does, it's a perfect example of the Internet of Thinking. It's connected, but at the time that it detects a signal in the brain that an epilepsy fit is about to occur, it doesn't have the time to send it up to the cloud and work out what to do. It's been given the intelligence to send certain pulses which can help rectify that. And as a result, for the people that have implemented this, they've seen a 44% reduction in epilepsy. And so that brings it to a very real level at a human being. But all those devices, the car, remember I said earlier, the Audi at the level 3, it needs to be able to communicate to the cloud to know where it is on the virtual mapping system and to guide you. But also, at the point of it's got a decision to make, and this is one of the big things with autonomous vehicles. Even my 13-year-old son, I referred to earlier, he came home from school and he said they were learning about if you're driving a car down and a road and your brakes fail, and there's somebody on your left, three children, or somebody ahead of you, an elderly person, he said, like me, or there's a cliff on the right where you could take your own, what do you do? They were asked this at school to teach them about how you make those decisions in that split second. And the point is, as we go to autonomous vehicles, those sorts of decisions are being programmed in. That's just a fact. And so, you know, there's obviously big ethical and philosophical issues, but putting that intelligence into the network is happening, and that example kind of brings it to life. So what I might do is try to bring this whole thing together. Really, today was just to get you thinking, to stimulate some ideas, to share with you what augmented reality looks like a little bit, and to maybe, you know, maybe take this back to your jobs as actuaries, thinking about mortality tables, thinking about insurance by the mile. I know you heard about it this morning. And I know we heard a skeptic's view earlier about pooling of risk. I think there's going to be both. I think we will pool, but you'll also tailor individually, more individual tailoring of risk, of life expectancy, of health and illness, and tailor pricing and policies to that, as well as using AI in the upfront discovery and selling phase, as well as using it in the fraud and the back-end claims process. And we see that happening at insurance companies in pockets around the world. You know, we have this great slide that shows different industries, which industries are the most disrupted, media, which are the least disrupted. I would say as I told you at the beginning, I don't know that much deeply about actuarial science, but I would say you're on the less disrupted end so far. But I would say the change, when it hits, it's faster than you can imagine. And I'd encourage you to take this back to your work and think about it and hopefully you got something valuable out of the presentation. So I'll wrap up there.
Well, thanks, Trevor. I'm going to get you to stay here because we've got a few minutes for questions, and I'm thinking, I know it's the end of the day, but I'm thinking that would have stimulated a lot of thoughts for a lot of people. But what I was thinking was, I guess, out of those five big trends, and you mentioned a couple of applications for actuaries during your talk, but which of those big trends do you think we should be most focused on and will be most relevant for us in our profession?
Okay, so, I mean, for the five trends, you know, often the combinatorial effect, by the way, of the trends is where the big disruptions occur. Driverless cars is actually five different technologies that really enable the big disruption. But I'd say the big two for actuaries, as I think about it, are AI, how you think about your models and your old model of sampling and stochastic analysis, etc., and potentially using big data to learn and discover and personalise. And I'd say that together with data, the AI and data, to me would seem the most obvious. And there are startups and companies doing that, in fact, today. So those would be the two of the five. Other questions?
Come on, there must be a couple from the floor. I was interested in your story about the guy with his finger on the nuclear response button. And he was picking that this was an anomaly, but I was thinking, would an AI actually have been able to do that? Because it would have just looked at that stimulus and sent the rockets back the other way.
Well, that's why we don't believe. I mean, this whole thing about AI is coming to take your jobs, I think it's humans plus machines. I think there's a partnership there. We've been using it. In fact, a lot of the stuff I spoke today, you're using AI, but you're just using it. It's about people and how they apply it. So we actually see a whole set of new jobs, the trainers, explainers, sustainers, making the decisions with the system. I mean, if you think about credit scoring in a bank for a home loan or a credit card, you all know how it works. Goes into one of those two models, FairASX or Experian, incredible amount of data that's gone into it, comes up with a score. If you're over 700, approved. If you're below 500, declined, and it's somewhere in between, goes to human, and you know, you kind of make a decision. And I see clearly in your roles there's going to be massive opportunity to work with machines in interesting ways. But I don't see those decisions sitting with an AI.
So which industry? So you think there's big potential then in financial services?
Absolutely.
But it sounds like we're just at the infancy at the moment. Which industries have embraced AI?
Well, I'd say media.
Moment?
That's why I said earlier the media industry has been like. Those guys are really at the forefront of technology, whether it's the internet, whether they're dealing with the newspaper and how people read the news today. And, you know, it's been brutal, the impact on the media industry. And I'd say similarly with Netflix, you know, using AI, I'd say autonomous driving is a big one. But I think financial services, we know there's a lot of activity. There's a huge amount in financial services with data, but I think we see, you know, I would definitely be on the side of we see lots of disruption coming and lots of change, and I think there are huge consumer benefits, whether it's much cheaper. I mean, think about buying shares 20 years ago, what you paid for brokerage versus today. Sending money overseas 10 years ago versus what you can do today. There's huge consumer benefits that are flowing through, and I think we'll just see an acceleration.
Lots of questions here on AI. This one says, AI is evolving so quickly. How do we ensure it's being used for good? Can risk controls keep up?
That's why we call it citizen AI. So, you know, the question, that's the question, is we need to hold ourselves accountable. And by the way, I think government's got a very big role to play. And that's why we say the sustainers and explainers. And I think there's the trainers, sustainers, explainers. I think ultimately if an industry or companies go off track, government's role is to step in and regulate. And because in my notes, it's like people have a right to know how decisions are made, why they're made, and to have it explained. And I think you need that human plus machine to explain, to give you transparency. So I think, I've just kind of lost the train of your question again.
It was around risks and controls.
The risk, yeah. So yeah. I think it's responsible AI starts with us as individuals, people of integrity, like in this room, in important roles, in companies, you know, speaking out about the moral compass, And then I think ultimately it's about government stepping in and regulating. And I think there's a real massive role for regulation, consumer protection. I think it starts with people like the, you know, the people organizing this conference, the Institute of Actuaries, to send positive signals about being responsible. And that's what Google was doing at their conference last week. The whole thing was called Responsible AI, because we have a responsibility. Now, kind of slightly a new territory, but that's...
Well, we've got a great plenary session tomorrow morning, which sort of goes a bit to this topic, so I'd encourage you to be there for that. Okay, final question. There was an interesting one here on climate change. Will these trends allow us to tackle the impact of climate change and nature fighting back?
Yeah. Well, I think the general insurance, I was studying some apps overseas, you know, just to see, you know, some of the startups that are currently the fintechs and AI sort of new upstarts. And there were a couple that were, you know, in general insurance, were looking at how they take, you know, how they factor nature into their decisioning. And then the question about nature fighting back, meaning...
I think it was just around how this technology would help us combat some of the climate change
right,
effects.
Yeah.
Okay, I might do a final one.
Okay.
this is a great one. Could you use technology to determine whether lifetime annuitants are still alive? Maybe if you strap the smartwatch on them, you can tell the moment their heart actually stops beating. one final one, serious one. Is the hardware up to it? Reliability. I've had more breakdowns in my car than mental mental health issues. So.
I love that question. Is Black Mirror... could they see the questions up there?
No. No, I don't.
Is Black Mirror my favourite TV program? I don't know who asked that. If you haven't seen
show.
It, that's incredibly brilliant program. It's so futuristic. It really makes you think. I think it's on Netflix, isn't it? It's on Netflix. It's really
worth
watching.
But it's near future. It's very, very believable and quite horrible.
It's very believable, but it just pushes the
edge.
Highly
recommended.
And you can kind of walk away from some of those episodes thinking, you know, it's like kind of just a little bit too close and scary, but it's worth watching.
Trevor,
there's a new series, yeah.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Trevor for his presentation.
Thank you.
Okay.
Actually, if I can thank you, Julian, and Decora, who helped practice with me. This was Thursday we started practicing on this because I've never used this before, so I really owe them a big thanks.
And thanks to Nicolette for pushing the boundaries.
Nicolette.